Did you know that you could be covered from head to toe in thick mud and still be ritually clean? Did you know that you could be squeaky clean inside and out and be ritually unclean? It's true. Ritual cleanliness is a much misunderstood aspect of ancient life, and not just in the Bible. All ancient cultures had ideas about the boundaries and acceptability, and they were pretty much similar regardless of whether one was Egyptian, Babylonian, or Hebrew. Certain things made people absolutely unclean, defiled, unacceptable for inclusion either in society as a whole, like leprosy, or for certain ritual activities like participation in the ritual cult. Uncleanness could be temporary, like the types dealing with certain body secretions, or permanent, as we see in certain caste systems like India with their population of untouchables, where certain people are considered to be born into a permanently unacceptable state and are thus inherently inferior and perpetually unworthy. So what was the absolute worst form of impurity in ancient Israel? Corpse impurity. But what does that have to do with the sixth woe comparing the Pharisees to unwashed tombs? And that's a pretty cool story. Hi, I'm Tyler Dawn Rosenquist, and welcome to Character in Context, where we explore the historical context of Scripture and talk about how it bears on our own behavior and witnesses image bearers. You can find my teachings on my website, theancientbridge.com and contextforkids.com, as well as on my YouTube channels, which are accessible from my websites. You can also access past broadcasts on my podcast channel, characterincontext.podbean.com, and my context books for adults and families are available through amazon.com. Oh, and my podcasts are also available on iTunes now. However, I just saw a news story where they're about to get rid of iTunes. So I may have gone to all the trouble of getting onto that for nothing, which is really pretty hilarious. I guess they're going to have separate apps for podcast music and such and not lump them all together anymore. It'd probably be better. Anyway, this week we're covering my favorite woe to teach, which is woe number 6. Unlike last week's woe, which I hated teaching. Now let's take a look at it. Starting in verse 27 of Matthew chapter 23. Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites! You are like whitewashed tombs, which look beautiful on the outside, but on the inside are full of the bones of the dead and everything unclean. In the same way, on the outside you appear to people as righteous, but on the inside you are full of hypocrisy and wickedness. Dang. I've seen people use whitewashed tombs so often as an insult, not really understanding anything about the cultural context, and that's true with almost every insult in the Bible. It sounds holy, so they use it so they can insult somebody while feeling good about themselves, right? You know, we have a whole internet land filled with people who just want to grab onto any biblical insult they can, you know, to punish people who disagree. Sometimes they're just putting lipstick on the pig of, you know, their overgrown egos and underdeveloped humility. And I've done it too, so I'm not just a, you know, they. It's been me too. I know this is going to shock you guys, but sometimes people disagree with me because I'm wrong. I know. Let me just give you a minute to pick yourselves up off the floor from the shock of it all. But, you know, seriously, sometimes people disagree with you because you're wrong too. Which is why Yeshua, or you might call him Jesus, repeats this over and over again. Anyone who humbles himself shall be exalted, and anyone who exalts himself shall be humbled. And that's not just for guys, that's for us ladies too. Nothing, and I mean nothing, is more humiliating than being a jerk to somebody and finding out you were wrong and needing to apologize. In fact, it's so awful that a great many people, even once they find out they were colossally and publicly wrong in things that they've proclaimed and taught, they can't bring themselves to face it or admit it because the humiliation of owning it and apologizing would be more than the love in their hearts can manage to get over, okay? They might sidestep and just start teaching the new thing without admitting their old error, or ignore that they were wrong and come at their debunked belief from a new angle just to find a new way to be right, when they're actually just wrong, 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 and they needed to admit that. They need to own it. Embrace wrongness. Embrace the knowledge that you are wrong about stuff you fervently believe. You just don't know what those things are yet. I say I'm wrong about a lot of stuff. Just don't ask me what they were, because if I knew, I wouldn't be wrong anymore, would I? Unless I keep teaching it. But, okay, whitewashed tombs. There's a misconception out there that the tombs were whitewashed for the purpose of beautifying them. But that was just a side effect. Remember, the audience was Jewish pilgrims who had just traveled to Jerusalem for Judea, Galilee, Perea, the Transjordan, and even some from the diaspora communities, which means the communities of Jews outside the land in places, you know, the Jews from Babylon, where the trip would take a great many weeks. Ezra's journey took 4 months, and of course he was traveling with families, and a pilgrimage trip would probably only be wealthy males, but still it was a 900-mile trip. In the first century, the two largest and wealthiest diaspora communities on earth were from Babylon, most Jews never returned to Israel from exile, and Alexandria in Egypt, where a lot of them were actually taken forcibly during the Greek times. It was considered a goal among the wealthy, and most diaspora Jews were not wealthy. Most were slaves or at least very poor. But it was a goal among the wealthy to visit the temple in Jerusalem once in a lifetime. After all, the trip took so long that you were gone for months to even attend a single feast. There was no chance of going back and forth 3 times a year. In Acts 24, Paul talks about having been outside the land for years and finally returning for the Feast of Unleavened Bread / Passover. So Acts 24, starting verse 16, "So I have always taken pains to have a clear conscience towards God and man. Now after several years, I came to bring alms to my nation and to present offerings." And I believe I'm taking these from the ESV. I've got it on a page, and I usually write down what version I use, but when it's not the Tree of Life version, it's almost always ESV, English Standard Version. Now, I am very much in agreement with the decades-old new perspective on Paul within Christian scholarship, where we see that Paul never stopped being a Jew, never stopped being Torah observant. But the gospel would never have spread beyond Israel if the Jews at this point, who were living in the diaspora, were returning 3 times a year for the feasts. He'd been gone several years. So we have this pilgrimage from all over ending up at Jerusalem for the Passover, which was the feast that most diaspora Jews strove to attend if they could only go once, you know, when they could go. But we have this problem of ritual purity. Most forms of ritual impurity were easily cured, you know, immerse in a ritual bath and be qualified for temple attendance and the eating of holy meat by sundown. Easy peasy, hot and cheesy, right? But corpse impurity was something entirely different. And we need to start this story in Numbers 19 with a red heifer. I am going to skip the preparation of the water for purification and go right to the problem and cure of ritual impurity. And of course, if you're ritually impure, you cannot... The more ritually impure you are, the farther you have to stay away from the Holy of Holies. Because there were zones of holiness extending outwards from the Holy of Holies. And you could only go so far, depending on what type of ritual impurity you had. All right, so Numbers 19, starting in verse 11. "Whoever touches the dead body of any person shall be unclean for 7 days." Unclean for what? Unclean for, temple attendance. But remember from last week, this is Avi Avot HaTumah. This is the granddaddy of impurities. Okay? Now, you know what? I'm just going to read it and then we'll talk about it later. He shall cleanse himself with water. So I'm going to start again. Whoever touches the dead body of any person shall be unclean 7 days. He shall cleanse himself with the water. This is the water with the red heifer ashes. On the 3rd day and on the 7th day, and so be clean. But if he does not cleanse himself on the 3rd day and the 7th day, he will not become clean. So this doesn't wear off. Whoever touches a dead body, the body of anyone who has died, and does not cleanse himself, defiles the tabernacle of the Lord, and that person shall be cut off from Israel. Because the water for impurity was not thrown on him, he shall be unclean. His uncleanness is still on him. This is the law when someone dies in a tent. Anyone who comes into the tent, and everyone who is in the tent, shall be unclean 7 days. So you don't even have to touch the dead body. Just have to be in the same room, in the same house. And every open vessel that has no cover fastened on it is unclean. Whoever in the open field touches someone who was killed with a sword or who died naturally, or who touches a human bone or a grave, shall be unclean 7 days. For the unclean, they shall take some of the ashes of the burnt offering, and fresh water shall be added in a vessel. Then a clean person shall take hyssop and dip it into the water and sprinkle it on the tent and on the furnishings and on the persons who were there and on whoever touched the bone or on the slain of the dead or the grave. And the clean person shall sprinkle it on the unclean on the 3rd day and on the 7th day. Thus, on the 7th day, he shall cleanse him, and he shall wash his clothes and bathe himself in water, and at evening he shall be clean. Because remember, the day in the Bible begins and ends at sundown. But the temple day actually begins and ends in the morning. So that's the temple day, because you're offering the sacrifice and... You know what? We're going to talk about that some other time. But the day begins and ends at sundown, because that's when you become clean. That's a new day. Literally! Okay. Now, if the man who was unclean does not cleanse himself, that person shall be cut off from the midst of the assembly, since he has defiled the sanctuary of the Lord, because the water for impurity has not been thrown on him, he is unclean, and it shall be a statute forever for them. The one who sprinkles the water of impurity shall wash his clothes, and the one who touches the water of impurity shall be unclean until evening. And whatever the unclean person touches shall be unclean, and anyone who touches it shall be unclean until evening. So last week we talked about corpse impurity, and it was the most, a human corpse was the most severe deliverer of impurity. You can just even be in the same room with a corpse and you've got corpse impurity. So guess what? We all have corpse impurity. We are all of Hatumah, fathers of impurity. Everyone! The whole world and anything we touch becomes, you know, impure. Sorry guys, anyone who thought that they could remain ritually pure, we just can't. We've all got corpse impurity. That's why we need the ashes of the red heifer. All right. So corpse impurity. Remember, I read from Barakot 8:2 last week in the Kahati commentary. And in the introduction, you know, again, corpse impurity was Avi Avot Hatuma. Father of fathers of impurity, but I call it the granddaddy of defilement. It's the grand kahuna of being ritually unclean, the corpse. No living person is that unclean, mind you, but a dead person is. Corpse is so unclean that a high priest couldn't even attend a family member's funeral or visit the body after death or the grave. If you are even in the same room with a corpse, you are av hatuma, father of impurity. This is totally biblical. And so taking a sidestep away from the main teaching here, you know, what does that mean for us when there are no red heifer ashes? It means that everyone, Jew and Gentile, has incurable ritual impurity. We are all fathers of impurity. We're mothers of impurity, you know. Unless you have been sequestered away all your life and have never been around a dead person, never were in a church for a funeral, never sat Shiva with a grieving family, which is considered a good deed, a mitzvah, then you have serious ritual impurity. I want you to think about this the next time somebody gives you the stink eye, if you're a woman, for menstrual impurity, because it is only traditional to make a fuss over this as though the corpse impurity doesn't exist. Everyone gets a big fat pass on that one. Even though we're all have the equivalent impurity level of being in a continual state of nidah, which is menstrual impurity. Of being a zav or a zava, someone who has an abnormal emission like gonorrhea. Or a mitzora, which means disease, skin disease, which is often translated as leprosy. And that's both male and female. I'm not saying not to be mindful of observing God's laws concerning nidah, but let's seriously keep this in perspective. We ladies aren't contaminating anyone beyond their permanent level of impurity. But, back to corpses here. How many times do you say that in your life? Back to corpses. Corpses don't seem to have an expiration date on ritual defilement. And actually, there are several instances in scripture of old bones being used to defile pagan altars. During the first century, it's reported the Samaritans tried to defile the Temple Mount with human bones because they were so outraged at the temple being in the wrong place. Of course, they believe the temple should be on Mount Gerizim, and they worship there to this day. So, still though, defilement wasn't a big hairy deal as long as you had 7 days warning before going to the temple, because that's how long purification took. So let's reread the verses for today so we don't forget the point of all this, which wasn't to teach Numbers 19. Starting in verse 27 of Matthew 23, "Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites! You're like whitewashed tombs, which look beautiful on the outside, but on the inside are full of the bones of the dead and everything unclean. In the same way, on the outside you appear to people as righteous, but on the inside you are full of hypocrisy and wickedness." Well, here we have Yeshua verifying that everything inside a tomb is unclean, and the tomb itself is also unclean. But, what's the big deal? Well, just imagine taking a nice family trip to Jerusalem for the Passover. Little Johnny, or Yohani, I guess, he needs to pee. I'm the mother of boys. I know how the world works. He wanders off the path and finds himself peeing on the stone covering a tomb entrance. Oops. They weren't all huge and obvious all the time. Oh no, little Johnny has encountered Avi Avot Hatuma, and now he is Av Hatuma, and everything the little rascal touches is ritually defiled in the first degree, one step down from Johnny and two steps down from a corpse. Johnny can't participate in the Passover, and it's going to be really tough for the rest of the family to not be repeatedly defiled by him. All they have to do is ritually wash and be clean once the sun sets, but Johnny needs a 7-day purification ritual. This is all biblical. I'm not making this up. This is not rabbinic. This has just gotten ugly in the extreme. But wait. The good news is they had already enacted some laws concerning this that aren't specifically in the Bible, but derived from the requirements for ritual purity when eating the Passover. So we are going to look at Shekelim 1:1, which I have to reach way far for because I didn't put it in the right spot. And I like Shekelim. I enjoyed reading Tractate Shekelim. I did. Not like Kalim. Not like Shavuot. But I liked Shekelim. I like a lot of the tractates, just not all of them. All right, so Shekelim 1:1, this is found in Seder Moed, which is the division of the Mishnah concerning the feasts. It's wedged in between Pesachim, which is dealing with the Passover, and Yoma, which is dealing with Yom Kippur. And again, I am reading out of the Kahati commentary as usual. So here we've got, on the first day of Adar. Adar, of course, is the 12th month of the biblical calendar. On the first day of Adar, they announce concerning the shekels and concerning the kilayim, which we will not be talking about. On the 15th of it, they read the Megillah in the cities. That's the Esther scroll. And they repair the roads and streets and the mikvaot of water. And they attend to all the public needs. And they mark the graves. They also go out for the kilayim. So there are a few things here. One, the specific timing of the collection of the temple tax, which shows up in the Gospels. So you know that when you see all the stories about the temple tax, does your teacher pay the tax? We are in the month of Adar. This is in the late winter before the spring. The need to refurbish the mikvaot, the ritual baths, at the end of winter because they were often rendered unusable in the winter. Again, I mean, they would fill with silt. They were outdoors. The rains were heavy in the winter. Again, you know, so much for the myth of perpetual ritual purity in ancient times. It would be extremely difficult and sometimes even impossible, and they clearly point that out here. They're not trying to hide anything. When the spring came, they needed those baths in working order for the beginning of the feast year, which began with the beginning of months in the month of Nisan, as opposed to the beginning of the agricultural and civil year, as we see in the Hebrew Gezer calendar, beginning in the seventh month. We also see this as the beginning and end of the Shemitah cycles in the seventh month and the tithe years. It's just like in modern times where we have multiple calendars, we have the tax year, the school year, the civil year, blah, 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 blah. But most important to this week's study is the whitewashing of the tombs. Let me put my book back over here now. And put something in it to leave it open. Now, this was done specifically, this whitewashing of the tombs was done specifically so that little Johnny can't stumble across a tomb accidentally and become defiled for the Passover. Like I said, not specifically commanded in the Bible, but obviously an excellent and much needed idea. And that is what a lot of the Mishnah is about. Not the nitpicky debatable stuff like last week's topic, but solid practical application of how Torah was lived out in ancient times and in a temple-centered society. Getting seriously ritually defiled within a week of Passover meant game over. Try again next month for second Passover, which isn't like second breakfast, okay? You had to come back a month later and hope it didn't happen again. So no extra juice boxes for little Johnny as they're making the long hot trek down up to Jerusalem. Anyway, so they would make the pilgrimage from home to Jerusalem. They would see those family tombs gleaming from being painted with white lime. And just, okay, when we think of tombs, we think of green cemeteries. We think of green grass. They're surrounded by fences. We see the gravestones. So we say, well, it's obvious. You know, it's like, no. that was... You know, the tombs blended in. They were carved out in the rock and covered with rocks. The family knew where they were. Not so much anybody else. If you weren't around there, if you were just passing through, you did not know where the tombs were. I mean, how could you? So as they would make the pilgrimage from home to Jerusalem, they would see those family tombs gleaming from being painted with white lime. And when people saw them, their reaction wasn't, oh, how pretty. It was keep away. You know, like bears are nice looking, as long as you're in your car. Or swarm of bees on your television set, or out pollinating a pretty field of flowers. Skunks are cute too, but not up close. On my, or my husband's evil cat. And no, that was not a joke. You have no idea. Sometimes when I'm recording, she pounds on the door. Ba-boom! 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 just like the Telltale Heart and Edgar Allan Poe's story. Anyway, now that we've talked about something really scary, we're going to take a break so you can recover from having to think about my husband's evil cat. And we will be right back to talk more about whitewashed tombs. So hi, I'm Tyler Don Rosenquist, and welcome back to the second half of Character in Context. And we have been talking about, again, the woes of Matthew chapter 23, the woe to you scribes and Pharisees, over and over and over and over again. And we've been covering the sixth woe this week, the whitewashed tombs, which is actually my favorite because it's actually one of my favorite pieces of context from the Mishnah, because it's just so clear that even I can understand it. Oh, shoot. So, you know, whitewashed tombs, like we were saying, they looked nice, but people saw the whitewash as a clear warning. And this is what Yeshua was saying about the Pharisees and their scribes. He's telling people to walk the other way when they see them coming, to stay clear, to avoid them, lest they become defiled. And that's some serious mojo there. Woe to you. We're going to read it again. Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites. You are like whitewashed tombs, which look beautiful on the outside, but on the inside are full of the bones of the dead and everything unclean. In the same way, on the outside, you appear to people as righteous, but on the inside, you are full of hypocrisy and wickedness. You know, some versions use lawlessness. And anomia, lawlessness. It means being contrary to God's laws, not keeping the commandments. But, goodness sakes, the Pharisees kept the external parts of the commandments, and often, I mean, on steroids. They did find ways around, though as we've been talking for the past however many weeks, and I keep forgetting even though I talk about it all the time. Now, I want you to remember from part one in this series, polemic, and polemic is just a word that means Hellenistic insults. Okay? Remember, first century Judaism was very Hellenistic. People like to think that anything from Jewish is Hebraic. No. Judaism, from that time forward, is remarkably Hellenized. And a lot of the Hellenism was good. Synagogues showed up only in Hellenistic times. Synagogue is actually a Greek word. It means standing or stand together. And can't remember all of a sudden. Or is that Sanhedrin? Oh, goodness sakes, I should have written it down. Oh, I've got too much stuff in my mind and it's not all filed properly. Anyway, so the synagogues, they got that from the Greek. The disciple, or the rabbi disciple thing, the teacher disciple, that is Greek. It never existed. We don't see that. We see schools of the prophets, but that's it. That's completely different than the teacher-disciple stuff that was going on in the first century. That was Greek. It's a great system. It works. It still works today. We like it. Okay? Let's think of what else. Polemic here that was used by the Essenes and by the Pharisees and by Josephus, by Philo, by so many Jewish and Gentile writers. It's polemic was about a battle for authority over who was the most suitable teacher and who had the legitimate school of thought. And remember, Josephus, who himself was a first century Jew, he called himself a Pharisee. He was priestly. He called the Pharisees one of the four philosophies within Judaism. Philosophies in those days, and this is all review, meaning a school of thought. Philosophies were all dedicated to leaving behind evil and adopting a virtuous way of life, and everybody had different ideas about how to go about that exactly, and so those different ideas were kind of formalized into philosophical schools. And of course, the Essenes and the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and especially the fourth philosophy, which was later on in time, the Zealots, had very different ideas about how to live righteous lives. So, like I said, this polemic was part of a battle for the hearts and minds of the gathered Passover pilgrims. This was Messiah come. This was God's perfect representative, his true image bearer, come to earth saying that he, and only he, was the only completely authoritative and legitimate arbiter of God's law, God's wisdom. Other groups might get things right and sometimes very wrong, like the Hillel ruling on divorce for any cause was flat out denounced by Yeshua. But they were human and flawed. Messiah is the representation of God's absolute wisdom in the flesh, and his teachings were always absolutely correct. He didn't get it wrong. He didn't lead people in the wrong direction. Now, the Pharisees, who called themselves guides to the blind, were leading people away from God by continually trying to undermine Yeshua and leading people away from him. And not all of them did that. We know that from the text. And I think it's in Acts 15, it talks about how many Pharisees were among the believers in Yeshua later. They were literally insulting God by failing to recognize his character perfectly revealed in Yeshua. As such, they were a dangerous and defiling influence at this time within Judaism. It wasn't about their oral traditions. It wasn't about the traditions of the elders. It was about their influence and how they were using it to keep people out of the kingdom of heaven. And this is all going to culminate in the grand finale in the teachings over the next 2 weeks. But we're beginning to start to see the larger picture that I've been building to for all this time. What the woes were actually about. Why was Yeshua taking this time? Now, over the past chapters that had gone before, I didn't teach these, but I'm going to teach them when I teach about the parables as I keep going. He'd already taken on the Sadducees. He'd taken on the Herodians. He'd taken on the elders. Nobody was going unscathed here. It was time for him to die and lead the second exodus at the cross. The exodus that wouldn't just deliver the Israelites from slavery in Egypt, but would begin the process of delivering the entire peoples of the world, well, not every single person, but you know, the peoples of the entire world, Jew and Gentile, out of their bondage to sin and death. That's why it's greater, because one, it's not just the children of Israel and the mixed multitude. That was a very, very small amount of people. And it's not only deliverance from literal slavery to literal Pharaoh. This is not just small group of people. This is the world. This is Jews and Gentiles. And it's not just leading people out of not having to work hard. It's leading people out of bondage to actual sin. Sin, which is inside and outside. It's not just externally imposed labor. It's freedom on the inside. It's freedom on the outside. It's freedom everywhere. And death. We're all subject to death. So we're talking about the world to come being open to all peoples through alliance with the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob on his terms through his one unique son, Yeshua, by looking at Yeshua and saying, there, write that. If God came to earth and lived among us, he'd be doing what Yeshua does. He'd be teaching what Yeshua teaches. He'd be delivering people and healing them and doing all these things. And he would not break bruised reeds, and he would not do this and he would not do that, but he would do these things, and he would battle evil and he would win. But you know, now has come the time for Yeshua. It's his last Passover, and he knows his death is near, and now he needs to make his stand. See, up to this time, he's been teaching, he's been delivering, he's been healing. He has not made his stand. This is his stand. His stand is, I am the only legitimate, absolute authority on earth. It's been handed over to me by God the Father. And through the instrument, and one of these days we'll do a teaching on what is salvation and why did Yeshua have to die the way that he died. But I talk about that in Context for Kids, Volume 4. Image-bearing idolatry and the new creation in the Bible. I don't even know what my own books are called. I don't read them. Would you read, if you read a book, would you read it? No. No, you never want to look at it again. But I talk about the salvation and why the death on the cross and that sort of thing. We'll talk about it briefly some other time because it's an important concept. And it's one of the questions I get asked the most often. But, you know, I digress here. So Yeshua's come to die, but he has to take his stand. And he has to say that, you know, it's me or it's them. If you believe them, then I have a demon. I'm a Samaritan. I'm not the Messiah. I'm this and I'm that, and I'm all the things that they've said when they undermine me. I'm a Sabbath breaker and all those things. Or you can believe me and my interpretation of God's laws, and you can look at the works and you can say, yeah, this is obviously the Messiah. And so that's the final showdown. Who do we ally ourselves with? Do we ally ourselves with the worldly powers, with the worldly authorities, or do we ally ourselves with the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob through his one unique son, which is the form that he has chosen for us to declare our loyalty towards him? For seeing Yeshua, behold the man, is what Pilate said. Pilate said, behold the man. Yes, we look at him and we see, does this look like God on earth to me? What God would do if he was on earth, and what God would teach, and how God would deliver, and how God would love, and how God would forgive, and how God would do all these things. It's really just that simple. This is about loyalty. This is about salvation, not through genetics, but salvation through allegiance alone. That's actually the name of a book. And I can't remember who wrote it. I think his name's Michael. No, that's another one, but I can't remember. But it's salvation through allegiance. Now, how we respond to that allegiance shows how obedient we are and how much we are surrendering our lives to him. But again, as we've seen here, Yeshua just rebuked the Pharisees for lawlessness and wickedness when they're keeping the commandments on steroids. So it's about more than externals. You got to keep them on the inside too. So let's look at this final showdown. We're going to go through it one more time, then we're going to sign off for the day. For the week, and next week we're going to get into, boy, the rubber's going to hit the road next week, big time. So first, the scribes and Pharisees get rebuked for coveting and misusing authority. Second, they get rebuked for going to great lengths to get people to join their faction, while separating any converts from Yeshua through their constant attempts to undermine him with their nitpicking and their outright lies at times, accusing him of being demon-possessed and a Samaritan. And I gotta say really quick here, Yeshua wasn't the only one who was slamming the Pharisees of the first century? The Talmud does too. It says that there were 7 different types of Pharisees and only 2 types were righteous. Josephus calls them hypocrites in many ways, and he was one of them. The Talmud calls them hypocrites in many ways. So Yeshua is not speaking outside Judaism. He's speaking as a Jew within Judaism about a very serious phenomenon that was going on. Anyway, so like I said, they accused him of being demon-possessed and a Samaritan, so they were undermining him at any cost, whereas when he would undermine them, he would use their own stuff against them. He wasn't making stuff up. He wasn't just making baseless charges because he was frustrated. Okay, third. They get rebuked for bringing God and his temple to shame with their mockery of oaths, creating loopholes that give them the ability to weasel their way out of their yes being yes and their no being no. Well, if you do it this way, it doesn't really count. If you do it this way, it absolutely does count. So their integrity was in question, and that was bringing God's integrity into question. Fourth, they're focused on their own well-being, micromanaging their tithing in order to maximize their observance of the commandments, while being blind to the needs of the recipient of the tithe, the poor and vulnerable who need mercy and justice. Fifth, they are overly focused on the legalities of cleansing cups and pots and beds while neglecting the circumcision of their own hearts. And if you have read the Torah and if you've read the prophets, you know that the circumcision of the heart comes up over and over and over again. God continually was saying, keeping these laws is not enough to save you. If you do not clean yourself up on the inside, circumcise your heart so you will be on the inside like you're projecting yourself to be on the outside, or all this is meaningless. And it was, because over and over again, you know, the nation of Israel was never exclusively monotheistic throughout the monarchy and throughout the time of the judges. And they were always worshiping other gods on the side because their hearts weren't circumcised. Okay, sixth, they are a straight up defiling influence among the Jews for their part in the rejection of the Messiah among the Judeans. Remember, the Galileans accepted him. It was the Judeans who did not, because that was the Pharisees' power base. And like I said, there are only 6,000 of these guys. They made up like such a small, like micro percent, like a small percentage of 1% of the Jews, that we can't paint all of the Jews with this broad brush. Now there's one more woe to go, and then Yeshua is going to do something shocking. Or it's not shocking to us because we've read it so many times, but he's going to do something symbolic. He's going to leave the temple for the last time, and that's going to harken back to the book of Ezekiel, and we will talk about that, I believe, in 2 weeks. Now, whitewashed tombs. Again, I go through this every week. We read this stuff and say, yeah, those Pharisees. Okay, how does this apply to us? Well, I would say anyone is a defiling influence when they present themselves as an authority and yet lead people in the wrong direction. And here's the problem. Who is guilty of this ever thinks it applies to them? No, I'm the one who has it right. It's those other people. They're the defiling influence. They're the ones leading people in the wrong direction. But, you know, we've got a lot of teachers out there, and a lot of wannabe teachers out there, a lot of wannabe cult leaders out there who draw a following around themselves. And they would swear up and down. As a matter of fact, there's one. And I'm not going to mention any names. There is a teacher on the internet, and he consistently calls attention to himself. Actually, there's more than one. And they consistently call attention to themselves. And if somebody attacks them, boy, they're talking about it. If somebody disagrees with them, boy, they're talking about it. If somebody does this, somebody does that. And they make it sound like disagreeing with them is the same as disagreeing with God. Well, I'll tell you right away, right off, that with the exception of a few things, disagreeing with me is not automatically the same thing as disagreeing with God. All right? It's just not. You know, some people, they'll look at the same thing and they'll see different things. And I'm cool with that. And as long as it's not destructive, I don't really care that much because I'm not the final arbiter of truth and correctness. And I've been wrong enough times that I'm very, very cautious. I try to be cautious about what I teach. Of course, I've got blind spots just like everybody else. But, you know, any cult leader, any teacher who is so busy out there undermining everyone. See, if somebody does what Yeshua is doing here and is out undermining everyone who disagrees and everyone who everything, well, when Yeshua did it, he was doing it to draw people after him. To say, look, they're telling you not to follow me. Don't listen to them. John the Baptist, when he was doing, he's saying, you know, they might tell you not to listen to what I say about the Messiah. Don't listen to them. Okay? They both had unique callings on their life. But if I say they're telling you not to listen to me, don't listen to them. It's like, well, I'm not the only teacher on the face of the earth. I'm not. And there are times when you shouldn't listen to me. I just don't know what they are. Sorry. You know, God has me on a need-to-know basis about my faults, and I know a lot of them, but evidently he's not ready for me to know all of them because every once in a while he just surprises me, and I just appreciate that so much. But like, if we were going to, so, you know, we got to be careful. We got to be careful that we're not being whitewashed tombs, that we're not drawing people away from the truth by drawing people after ourselves. Okay, you know, you got cult leaders wanting undue control over people. If you don't believe their take on doctrines, you are out of covenant. You are deceived. You are rebellious. You are listening to men and not God. Okay. I always laugh when a guy says this. If you're not listening to me, it's because you're listening to men and not God. But if I listen to you, I'm also listening to a man and not God, unless you are implying that you are God or the Messiah or his only authorized representative. You see, it doesn't work. No matter who you listen to, you're listening to men. Hopefully you're listening to ones that are correct. You know, of all the, we twist so many verses to our own benefit where, you know, we can, let's just not even go there. Okay. How about prosperity gospel preachers? How about, you know, they're just the obvious target, but you know, they make themselves an obvious target. If they are saying that if you are in favor with God, you will never lose your job. You will be driving a rich and fancy car. You'll be wearing suits and bling and fancy dresses, and you will have a yacht and a Gulfstream jet. And if you support me, blah, 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 blah. They're leading people in a wrong direction because I don't know about you, but I serve a Messiah who died, who wasn't rich, who wasn't well thought of by all the people all the time, who just kept on keeping on, who impressed people with what he did and who he was and not with bling. And then, of course, his disciples pretty much all died. And Paul was sick a lot, and Timothy was sick, and heck, Paul was shipwrecked, and he got stoned. I mean, no, not modern stone. He was actually pressed with rocks, and he was given the 39 stripes in the synagogues, and all these things happened to him. I don't know maybe they just didn't know enough of the prosperity gospel to avoid that kind of stuff. Or maybe the prosperity gospel is just not really all that accurate. It leads people away from life in God, because if you think this life is going to be easy and then it turns out not to be, you're going to hightail it the other direction when what Watchman Nee, wonderful brother, would call the normal Christian life just happens to happen. Anyway, that's it for this week. We are heading into the grand finale and the exciting stuff next week and the week after, and I'm very excited. And I will see you then.